when you are able to hold lightly your own culture, it makes it a lot easier for you to be available to learn others.
My guest today is my good friend and amazing human being, Adrian Bazemore. Adrian is the director of training for the International Restaurant Division of Chick-fil-A Corporate. Adrian, welcome to Culture Matters. How are you?
Fantastic, Ricardo. Thank you so much for having me. Great to
have you. Great to have you. You and I met back at Coca-Cola when you were at Coke, right?
That's absolutely right. That was, wow. I mean, not quite, but almost a decade ago. So anytime we get a chance to connect, it's a treat.
Absolutely, man. Because we have several things in common, but we have one thing in common. Both of us love training and pedagogy and just developing great coursework, right?
Absolutely correct. Absolutely correct. That was one of the first things I noticed about you. That's one of the things I have a great passion and purpose around is the development of human beings. And you have done that, I think, masterfully in a lot of different arenas. So no wonder we get along so well.
What drew you to that field, Adrian? What, you know, at what age did you start kind of having that pull to, I want to teach, you know, I want to develop, I want to be able to influence people through more meaningful learning experiences?
Well, Ricardo, the answer might surprise you. My mom was an earth science teacher, eighth grade earth science teacher. And as a young kid, that's the last thing I wanted to do. I never wanted to teach. I wanted to be
really?
I wanted to do sales. And so that's what I did. And straight out of college, the first half of my career was in sales and sales management. I was very, very fortunate, very blessed that that part of my career was very successful, but it wasn't bringing me joy. I would make the number and would get the pat on the back and the accolades would come. And then I would be thinking to myself, so what else? What else is there? And after I'd had about enough of that, I ended up doing some introspective work just on my own, just about me. I wanted to know why I'm here. Why? What's my purpose? And in doing that work, I learned that I care more about human investment than I care about most anything else. And I found that in my home life, found that in church life, I found that in community life. I didn't necessarily have that professionally while I was really working on selling and chasing the number.
Right.
And it was at that point, I was about 27 years old, where I started to make the shift to what I do now, which is performance management, adult learning, training, development. That's where things turned for me. And I felt very, very complete that the reason that I'm here and the reason I exist, I'm now connected to throughout, even professionally.
And you've worked for some amazing companies, right? Because you've been at PepsiCo, yes. Georgia-Pacific, yes. Coca-Cola, and now Chick-fil-A. Talk to me a little bit about your culture. You know, what formed and shaped you? A little bit about your home life and just your family and, you know, where were you born and have you traveled in other countries? And let's talk about some of your cultural growth as a person.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Happy to. I was born and raised 1970s in Raleigh, North Carolina, small family of four, and got a very interesting start. My family, if you're thinking about just the U.S., started in Eastern North Carolina, kind of farm country North Carolina. And so, you know, that's where the family origin was from. It's farm country, still own a family farm. We grew up in our neighborhood in Raleigh. It was a really, really interesting background. So Ricardo, I lived in a double cul-de-sac. There was one way in, one way out. And it was probably at the time, the most international neighborhood in Raleigh. And I'd be willing to bet that.
Really?
If you came down the bottom of the hill, directly in the center, there was our house, the Bazemore house.
Right.
African-American family, right? Right next to us to the right, the Guptas from India. And then the Boyers from Austria. And then the Isingers from Germany. And then the Weirs from New Zealand. And the Wongs from China. And then on the other side, on the left, the Kajimas from Japan. And a mix of American families of all kinds of ethnicities and nationalities and descents. And so all of us as kids, we're kids. What do we care about? We don't care about any of that. We're kids. Let's go outside and play. Let's play kickball. Let's play foursquare. I think one of the oldest kids at that time had a very smart idea during the summer and suggested that we all go to each other's homes to eat and to hang out and to learn about each other's cultures. And we did just that. And it was Awesome. Go next door to the Gupta's house and would always ask Mrs. Gupta, why is the food so spicy? It's very good, but why is it so spicy? I would go to Mr. Wong's house and he and I would have a small disagreement. Of course, remember now, as a little boy, a small disagreement about why do I need to take my shoes off before I come in? I don't have to do that at home. You go to the Isinger's house. The food was so tasty. And you had all these pretzels that were there. Mr. Isinger really, really loved pretzels, like nothing I had ever seen. I'm like, well, tell me about that. And he was telling me about his childhood and that this was a type of comfort food. So it was great to grow up that way, but very, very unique as well. And as I grew older and started to learn more about being African-American societally in school, it was very, very interesting to see how my learning of that culture, which I'm certainly a part of, how I was able to kind of manage that with another cultural experience growing up that probably very few others who were African-American had at that time. It was a really, really unique background, but I feel like that has a lot to contribute to who I am now.
That's fascinating, man. I didn't know that about you. I really didn't. So that's just amazing. So when you're out there playing with these kids and stuff, like from Germany, from Japan, from India, and you're a kid, right? How old were you?
Oh, I was allowed to go outside at 5. So between like 5 and 12, this was our existence together.
Never crossed your mind, never thought, because you were all different in some way, you know, you were all diverse, to use today's terminology, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Did you ever feel like, oh, they must have some sort of prejudice towards me because I'm African-American? Or did you ever feel like that towards any of them? Or was there any of that, like, amongst kids where you can remember looking back where some kid said something to another kid about their ethnicity? Or did that ever happen amongst you guys or no?
As the kids, absolutely not. You know, it was really such an incredible blessing, Ricardo, because I can't necessarily say that for the parents. I think most of the parents got along.
Adults are weird people, right?
Hey, you know, on occasion there were a couple of rifts, but as kids, what we cared about was a universal thing. We cared about having fun. We cared about learning with each other. It didn't bother us that some of us had one complexion or another. It didn't bother us that some of us ate certain foods and some of us didn't. It didn't bother us that our parents may have believed what they have believed or what our, you know, home life, our respective home lives might have been. None of that mattered. What mattered was, what can we do together? And I think that's the beauty of how impressionable children are. Yeah. Children get down to the base stakes. They care about what matters most in that moment. And they're not going to be deterred by trivial things like, well, your hair is really, really blonde, or your hair is really, really curly. None of that stuff matters when it comes to what game are we going to play today? What are we going to do as far as, you know, the next lesson that we want to learn? Even going to summer school together, we all traveled in a big old pack. We all walked together.
Really?
And my first tough moment being African-American happened with all of us together. From summer school, we were latchkey kids. So we lived 1 mile away. It was a different time. You could all, as kids, walk together and it was actually safe. Walking together, and some, I guess, teenage boys in a Jeep were driving by. And that was the first time that I had ever heard the N-word used.
Really?
And I was 6.
Oh, my.
So, of course, I don't understand. We don't know these kids. I don't know what we've done. So I look at my sister, who was 10 at the time, and I said, who are they yelling at? Like, who are they mad at? And I remember her distinctly saying, you, me, Benny, and Nettie. Well, that was 4 kids out of like almost 15 kids. And I'm like, well, what did we do? And that's when the hard truth kind of broke down to me. So, you know, I easily got over that because I was with a group of people where that didn't matter.
Right.
But I was surrounded by that. Now, imagine if everybody was the same and that message is shared and, you know, now it's no question who you're talking to. Well, that puts you in a much different mind state. So it was such an incredible gift, Ricardo, to grow up the way that I did. I wish more people could grow up that way.
Fantastic. That's amazing. I remember when I was in, and we were the only Latinos in this particular school system. Mm. And the first Black student, his name was Daryl, lived in some apartments behind our house. And we had like 5 acres, so we had some land, right? Mm-hmm. And Daryl, this was like an all white school, right? I'm white, like color, right? But Daryl just gravitated to our home. And my dad's darker. He's kind of mestizo, you know, what we say in Spanish, trigueño. Mm. And it was kind of just the whole dynamic was interesting, right? But I remember, actually was a good friend of mine, I thought. One day I was walking in the hall in seventh grade, and he looked at me and he said, "Hey, you spick." Mm. And I thought, where'd that come from?
Yeah.
Right?
Absolutely.
And years later, do you know what spick means?
No, tell me.
It came from the law enforcement community.
Really?
And so law enforcement officers would actually call in and tell dispatch, "We have a spick." And so spick means Spanish person in custody. That's what spick means. It's an acronym.
Wow.
And so it literally is like, we've got your prisoner here, you know?
That's so crazy.
And so, yeah, it's just ridiculous stuff, you know? And I never wanted the friendship with him again. You know, we hung out together. It's just like, and when you're kids, you're just not thinking in those things. Then we hear it, we get it, right?
Okay.
So the school you went to, was it mixed race school, mixed ethnicity?
It was.
Sounds like it.
Yeah, it was, absolutely. Yeah. So a lot of the schools that you would find in Wake County were that way. You would find lots of people who are white, who are black, who are of Asian descent, who are of Latin descent. And it was a very, very normal thing. I think, you know, elementary school, middle school, high school, all the way through, I think it was very, very easy to get used to meeting somebody in class whose national descendancy was something very, very unique. Kids from Egypt, and you talk to them about what that means. You talk to people who are from respective countries in Latin America and what that means. I'll have to tell you this. It's interesting. I had a girlfriend in high school who was Egyptian. Mm. And when we took the SATs, I asked her, "Well, so what did you put? Like, after your name, what did you put?" She said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, did you check white? Did you check black?" Like, what did you put? She said, "I checked other." I said, but you look like me. You remember now, I'm 16.
Right, right, right.
He says, "Oh, Adrian, oh, you silly Americans. I am Egyptian."
Right.
"People come from Egypt."
Yes.
She said, "This is the only place I have ever seen where you're not really American. Like, nobody refers to each other as American. It's always these colors."
Yes.
"These distinctions." And of course, you know, from the mouths of babes, right? But that was such a profound lesson to learn. She was exactly right in a lot of respects.
It's absolutely true. I mean, even now on the census for Hispanics, which is ludicrous. I mean, we come from 21 different countries,
mm-hmm.
you know? And mm-hmm. so, you know, what Hispanics is like only in America, as you know.
That's right.
But now the government thought it necessary to put whether or not we're white Hispanic or not, you know?
Which, like, I can only imagine what that distinction could ever mean.
It's just so crazy. Our country is so driven by this whole thing about color.
Yep.
And I keep saying to people, our differences aren't really about color. They're about culture. And we're just bumping up against each other. And we're fighting with each other over cultural issues. Because I've seen, you know, depending on how people are dressed or how they act, right?
Absolutely.
Doesn't matter their color. And you know, if you put somebody from Boston and Birmingham and vice versa, there's schisms there, you know? I'm convinced that our issues are cultural in nature, but your friend from Egypt was absolutely correct. You know, I've interviewed on this show a person from Nigeria.
Mm.
And he said to me, actually two people from Nigeria I've interviewed on Culture Matters, and both of them have said to me, you know, "My kids are like, what's this whole thing about, you know, African-American, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Why aren't you just American?"
Yeah.
You know, have you ever seen Smokey Robinson's poem in Def Jam Poetry? It's called A Black American. Have you ever seen it?
No, I haven't.
Okay. You've got to watch it. It's like 5 minutes long. I'm going to send you the link after we get done here with this conversation.
Please do. I would love to see it.
Yeah. It's fascinating. You know, mm-hmm. It's just really thought provoking. You know, of course he's known as a singer, right?
Right. Right.
But he also does poetry. And so he did this, he has this poem called A Black American. I was going to ask you, like, in your experience, like in the cul-de-sac, right?
Yeah.
Was there like one culture that you were most attracted to?
I would have to say probably yes. So again, being a latchkey kid, if I, for whatever reason, forgot my keys, my instructions were go next door to the Gupta's house and hang out there until mommy or daddy get home.
Mm.
Well, whenever I forgot my keys, Mrs. Gupta never failed to feed. She fed me what she fed her family. There was nothing, you know, if I'm in her house, then I'm one of her children. And so I built a very, very strong affinity for Indian food, which of course, as you know, you're looking at India as a country. It's just, it's a huge, vast array of landscapes and of cultures within that country.
Yes. Languages, religions. I don't know, most people probably don't know this, but four of the world's major religions started in India, right?
And most people would not know that.
I had Sangram Vajray. He was one of my first guests on Culture Matters. He's the co-founder of Terminus, which is a business-to-business kind of a account-based marketing.
Mm-hmm.
And he went from India to the University of Alabama.
Wow. Oh, my goodness.
And he lives in Atlanta, by the way. So you and he should connect together.
Well, that'd be great.
You would love this guy, you know, especially if you love Indian people, you know.
Oh, no question. I'd love to hear what his experience was and kind of the culture shift he may have experienced in thinking about maybe how he grew up and then showing up at Tuscaloosa. Because, I lived in Birmingham for 2 years.
Did you really? Yeah.
Yeah. My wife and I started out really in Birmingham and lived there for a couple of years. And it was a great, great place for us, especially at that point in our lives. But it's different.
Oh, yeah.
As every place is. And so I would love to hear from him and learn more about what his experience was.
Listen to the conversation on Culture Matters with Sangram, because we talk about that. It's fascinating. But I'll be happy to introduce you to him.
That'd be great.
Hey, you'd love this guy.
It's interesting. It's when you're culturally adept and you're in tune, you never get there. There's never such a place as perfection.
Right.
But you get really, really sticky.
Yes.
And there are things that you learn in different places, and I know you know this well, that they stick to you. It's something that connects with you in such a way that it becomes then a part of who you are and your makeup. And it's something you can't release. So I absolutely maintain a great love and a great affinity for Indian culture and for all that I've learned of it. But I know that there's plenty more to learn. And I've kind of taken a stance of whatever the exposure is, whatever the opportunity to learn is, you know, I want to dive straight into it. If nothing else, you want to leave impressions with people that make them feel like, I'd love to have an encore with this person. And I love that.
And that's the beauty of people who are culturally skilled. So I want to give you an opportunity to teach. All right. Teach us what you've learned about connecting with other people culturally. Yeah. What lessons would you say to our listeners? If you're in a new culture, you're meeting new people, different from yourselves, think about this, this, and this.
Sure. Yeah. You're in a new culture. You're meeting with new people. You're not, let's say, on home turf. I would say one of the first things to remember is that your culture matters, but not as much as the culture where you are. And I think it's important to take that stance because it's not to say you have to disregard your own culture. We'd never ask you to do that. That's who you are. That's your
right.
Makeup.
That's right.
Your core self. I would ask you to hold that lightly enough that you could be available to another culture, another way, another set of behaviors, another style of thought, another sense of self. When you are able to hold lightly your own culture, it makes it a lot easier for you to be available to learn others. Doesn't mean that you have to like it. Doesn't mean that you have to agree with it. But you must put yourself in a position where your culture is not so right that another culture can't be right too. I feel like that's one of the gifts that international travel has taught me. The way that I grew up and the way that my household worked, all of that matters. And it matters to me. But where I was, that may not matter as much. I need to take a position more of learning before I do anything else. So I would say that's one very, very big lesson to take with anybody.
That takes humility.
It takes humility. It takes curiosity. It takes an understanding that all I know to be true is not necessarily all that is true. It's just
you should trademark that quote. You know that? Is that yours?
You know what? I've said it for a while. I'm sure I'm not the first person to say it. So
I'm going to quote you on that on Facebook. I am Adrian Bazemore on Culture Matters. Say it again.
All that you know to be true is not necessarily all that is true.
That's good, man. I like that.
Well, I'm just thankful for the opportunity to learn it. Because sometimes, Ricardo, you've come across people who are so convinced that they are right. Their way is right. This process is right. Well, okay. So it's right, what, universally? It's right unequivocally? It's right all the time, no matter what? Nothing else can be right? Well, I don't know about that. And if you put that to the test, you'll find out it's not necessarily true. So that was one of the best personal and professional lessons that I could take away. Another thing is doing due diligence to learn about who you're with, where you're going to be. For me personally, I've got a bit of a process where there's a series of dialogues, there's homework that I try to read up on, there's exposure that I seek before going to a new place. So I at least am starting to build my understanding about context, about expectations and etiquettes, about belief systems, whatever those things are. And it's not because I'm trying to change any of them. It's because if I know myself well, and I marry to what I know of myself, social awareness, then I can manage myself for the types of relationships that I want. And that's what this is about. It's self-management is what you can control, but self-management can be informed not only by what you know about yourself, but by what you know and learn about others. And if you've got a good process that helps you to learn more about other people, other places, other cultures, other norms, then you can make a very informed decision on how do I need to show up so I'm not disruptive, so I'm not a hindrance, so that and I love this, I know this is something that you say, so I'm going to quote you on this. For the purpose of the common good that we're seeking together, that I don't disrupt that. And I think that's a very, very special gift. And it's the gift that keeps giving.
Well, it's stage one in cultural mastery, you know, education. You do this before you get to stage two, which is engagement. There's two beautiful things that happen by having that previous preparation. Number one, you have so much more ability to actually connect when you do engage. But the other thing is you don't burn through relationships needlessly because you're just not even prepared. You don't know anything about the people or the culture. You know, I see on a very basic level, right? People who go to networking meetings at ethnic chambers of commerces, right? And they just show up. Well, I'm going to go to the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, right? Well, before you go, why not learn about Latinos, right? Why not maybe even go in and have a conversation with the director of the chamber and just open up your mind and your heart and your soul? So what you're saying, Adrian, I think is so critical. And I want to go back to something you said earlier, and that was, when people go into new cultures, have the humility to recognize that, yes, your culture is important.
Mm-hmm.
I loved how you said that because I haven't heard someone say it that way. And that is to hold your own culture lightly. Don't give it up. Okay. You are who you are, right? But hold it lightly. Don't go in with this moralistic, I'm right, you're wrong, right?
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. Ricardo, I have to tell you this. Professionally speaking, I've had the great fortune of working in a lot of countries within Latin America. And I have found a very universal truth for me is that as people saw me as somebody who was a very authentic and eager learner, making no assumption that I've got it, I've already figured this out.
Yeah.
I found in all of these different countries such patience, such grace, such a willingness to share more about what it was I was seeking to learn because I presented myself as somebody they could believe really wants to learn.
I love that about you, man. And I'm gonna vouch for you here that maybe you wouldn't say this, but you live what you're saying. I mean, you actually learned Spanish.
Yes. Thanks to you.
Well, I appreciate that. I remember you even went through our Successful Hispanics course, you know, and you are a learner, and that's why you've succeeded so much in your training and your career, because you've taken the time. Okay, I'm going to go work in Latin America, so I'm going to learn Spanish. And it's true. And I've had other people in corporate world say, well, professionals in Latin America speak English. That is true.
It is.
Right? For the most part, at high levels.
Mm-hmm.
But you'll never get to someone's soul through their second language.
Absolutely right. So beautifully said, Ricardo. I think that I have to tell you this. I think I may have told you this before, but I have to repeat it just in case. One of the things that was the straw that broke the camel's back that said to me, Adrian, you need to go and make sure, if this is something that you really want to do, that you know how to communicate well in Spanish. This was in my first career now, sales career. And one of my biggest customers is in Miami, Florida. And I'm at a trade show and having great success. And a vice president of Univision is talking with me and congratulating me on some awards that I had picked up. And then he leaned in, pulled me closer and said, it's a shame you didn't learn what you could have learned. And wow. I'm looking at him like, wait a second, I'm feeling really, really good right now. I've gotten all these awards. What did I miss? He said, well, you won awards, but you could have won people and you didn't.
Oh my.
It's because you never fully connected to our culture. And one of the lessons I learned in work that I did with you is that being able to communicate well was big. It's a huge, huge thing. It was, for me, an especially important bridge to understand, to be invited to the table to learn about a respective culture. And it never failed. When colleagues at Coca-Cola, let's say, met me in Uruguay or in Argentina, they meet me and then they really get off the surface and get a chance to know me. And we're talking in Spanish. And even though I'm communicating well in Spanish, they're correcting some words here. No, we say this, not that. There was something that they saw that says, this man has invested differently. He's gone further.
Yep.
Then let's meet him there. And that was an invitation to learn more about those respective cultures that I would not have gotten another way. So I'm appreciative of walking that journey with you. I think that's something that it's a universal truth. I don't think that works only in Latin America. I think that works anywhere with anyone.
You know, I got to tell you, I love talking with you. You know, I wish everyone had your spirit. And there's so much to learn from you.
I appreciate that. I appreciate it. I'm sorry.
if all of us had this spirit, curiosity, the desire to learn other people, and I just love how you said that, just holding our own cultures lightly when we go into other cultures, right? I have a good friend who said to me one time, and I actually quoted him in my book, The Six Stages of Cultural Mastery, and I want to read this because I think it just fits here so much, right?
Sure.
And he said, our pride tells us we are right about things. Our fear tells us not to entertain the idea that we might not be right.
That's spot on.
It's powerful because it's one thing to move into another culture and we just go, I'm right. But deeper than that, it may really be fear that motivates us to that kind of posture, right? And it's the fear of that, you know what? What happens if I move into that culture and I find out that they've got it right?
That's right.
That's threatening.
Which could undo all I've learned, which could undo or which could challenge all the investment made in me, which everything I believe to be true now, what else is? Like I get that discomfort and that fear, but only to a degree. You have to challenge that because the gift, it's almost like love. Love is something, whether it's, you know, romantic or platonic or what have you, when you have a relationship that's built on love, there's a vulnerability there.
Yes. And that's the goal, is to get to cultural endearment. So the goal is actually to get to love, not tolerance, you know, with other people.
Exactly.
So you've worked for these four amazing companies, maybe others, and I mentioned them earlier, PepsiCo, Georgia-Pacific, Coca-Cola, and Chick-fil-A. And now you're at Chick-fil-A, and you had said to me on another occasion that the retention rate at Chick-fil-A is like, what, 95% or something? It's just this amazing, unreal retention rate. What makes the internal culture of Chick-fil-A so special that people want to stay?
Yeah, I think one big thing about the culture at Chick-fil-A is that it's really not a secret to anyone. It's something that in a person's candidacy period, their first day, the 20th year, it's repetitive. It's the same thing over and over again. The purpose that we have as a business, the values that we have, the principles that we stand by, who we seek to be. We are very, very consistent about sharing that story. We want to have a positive influence on all who come in contact with Chick-fil-A. Well, you know, when you see people caring for one another, checking in on one another, not saying, hey, how you doing, as something you say when you're passing by someone, but asking that question and really expecting to kind of hear and invest in each other. When you hear concepts like how important it is not to just work hard together, but to do life together. I mean, those are very, very powerful sentiments. And there's nothing magical about it other than a really vested interest to live that out every day.
Well, I've been there. In fact, I was there with you about a year ago, I guess. And it just feels different when you go on the campus. There's a lot of oxygen. There are a lot of trees. The history there is clear. Now, internally within Chick-fil-A, is the culture inclusive? I'm just curious because you guys have taken a hit. You know, San Antonio Airport said no Chick-fil-A. Buffalo, I think, said no Chick-fil-A. And the whole reasoning has been that Chick-fil-A is somehow discriminatory towards LGBTQ plus community. What's been your experience internally with that? Is that even true?
My experience has been that Chick-fil-A is very inclusive. And I say that from a nationality perspective. I say that from an ethnicity perspective. I say that from a religious perspective. I say that from a lifestyle orientation perspective. My exposure to Chick-fil-A in the restaurants, my exposure to Chick-fil-A at the headquarters, at the support center, has been that Chick-fil-A is a very, very inclusive place.
So your children?
Yes.
Are they exposed to multiple cultures? Is that something that you have tried to ensure for them? Or do you predominantly stay in your family with African-American culture? What's your own experience with your kids?
With my kids, I have, and my wife, we have tried our very, very best to offer as much exposure as we possibly can to other cultures, to other countries. My youngest has, like me, appreciated the value of being able to communicate well in Spanish, and so she's on her journey with that. It's important to me. I know that the way I grew up is as I get older, it's so unique. I see more and more that that's just not easy to replicate, but I want as much as possible for my girls to have what I had. I want them to have exposure at an early age while they're still young and impressionable, that the way that the Bazemore household runs, that's the way that it runs. But that's not the only way. And there's some other really cool, interesting ways of living, of doing, of learning. And you need to go see it. You need to go be exposed to it. And with all of that, then you can determine as you become an adult, you go on your way, you can determine what makes the most sense for you. I want our girls, I would want all children to have that kind of choice. Some of that, though, only comes with the amount of exposure that you give. My girls get as much exposure as they can stomach. Sometimes my wife wants me to scale it down.
Well, there's a lot of wisdom there for parents, Adrian. My guest today has been Adrian Bazemore. You are a phenomenal human being. I'm honored to be your friend.
Ricardo, thank you so much. I appreciate you having me. Thank you for your friendship, man. Love being on this journey with you.
thank you for being on Culture Matters. You're awesome, man.